somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation. Episode 15. Paper Bullets. The Forgotten 17th Century Martyrs for Radical Free Speech and Democracy. Great Britain is a special place. Not only am I personally very fond of many things British, but British events and historical figures play a crucial role in the global history of free speech. That holds true even today as Britain tries to come to grips with how to handle free speech in a digital world. In July 2018, a committee in the British Parliament issued a report on fake news. The report recommended establishing clear legal liability for the tech companies to act against harmful and illegal content on their platforms. And in September, BuzzFeed News reported that the British government is already planning a new online regulator with powers to sanction social media platforms that fail to remove illegal content such as hate speech and terror propaganda. Already, more than 3,300 Britons were detained and questioned for grossly offensive comments on social media in 2016 alone, according to a 2017 article in the Times of London. That's 9 arrests a day. And earlier this year, a YouTuber was convicted for a prank video in which he jokingly taught his dog to do a Nazi salute and respond to pretty tasteless anti-Semitic tropes. Apparently, targeting offensive behavior is also a top priority for British police. In 2014, Police Scotland tweeted that they would monitor and investigate any offensive comments on social media. And not to be outdone by the Scots, the South Yorkshire Police recently tweeted an encouragement to report offensive or insulting comments. Add to this some pretty stringent anti-terrorist laws. In 2012, a British Muslim woman was imprisoned for a year for downloading Al-Qaeda's Inspire magazine on her mobile phone, although she was not suspected of being involved in actual terrorism. On the other hand, Britain is also home to a robust and often fierce debate. Dare I mention the word Brexit? And some of the most eloquent, smart, and wittiest defenders of free speech, ready to call out heavy-handed attempts to curb the tongues of Britons. These modern clashes over the permissible limits of free speech in 21st century Britain have long and deep roots in British history. In episode 12, I had what I hope you agree was a very enlightening conversation with the brilliant Teresa Bijan, where we discussed the political philosophy of Milton, Hobbes, Locke, and Roger Williams on the topic of free speech and tolerance. We also, ever so briefly, discussed the English Civil War, or wars, the bloody context that informed how several of these writers came to think about the merits or dangers of religious tolerance and free expression. But 17th century England saw many other developments which were central to the breakthrough of free speech as an individual constitutional right in the 18th century. Not least events in the tumultuous 1640s, where a group of radicals forced a discussion of first principles by demanding full liberty of conscience, abolishment of censorship, equality before the law, and representative democracy with universal male suffrage. As such, the so-called Levellers pried open a window that was swiftly shut back up, not to be fully reopened until more than a century later on the other side of the Atlantic. But before we get to the Levellers and the famous Putney debates, we probably need a brief historical overview and context focusing on developments in English censorship and religious tolerance. In episode 11, we left England during the long reign of Queen Elizabeth I, whose rule was less bloody than that of her sister Mary, but nonetheless introduced tight controls and stiff penalties for dissent, though more rarely for erroneous religious belief as such. Of course, outright blasphemy such as denying the divinity of Christ might still provoke the kindling of occasional human bonfires in Elizabethan times. Elizabeth died in 1603, paving the way for James I. He too was given to fighting anti-Trinitarians with fire, as Bartholomew Legate and Edward Wichmann would find out in 1612. But they were also the last Englishmen to be burned for their religious beliefs, and with them, prosecutions for the strange case of blasphemous heresy, a sort of mix between blasphemy and heresy, or wrong religious belief, became the exception for almost 30 years. Not that James didn't have his red lines. He seriously loathed Socinians and Baptists. Socinians had thrived in the mild religious climates of Poland, Lithuania, and Transylvania, as we discovered in episode 11. And from there, Socinianism spread westwards and across the Channel. Socinians, who would later develop into Unitarians, rejected not only the divine nature of Christ, and thus the Trinity, but also most sacraments, as well as one of the centerpieces of Calvinist belief, predestination, which was incompatible with the Socinian belief in free will. Socinians also rejected any official worldly authority in matters of religion. The great historian of blasphemy, Leonard Levy, argues that Socinianism became as hated, despised, and persecuted in the 17th century as Anabaptism had been in the 16th. Baptists, not to be confused with Anabaptists, rejected infant baptism, predestination, and were absolutely adamant in their belief in the strictly personal relationship between God and man, and that membership of the church was therefore voluntary. But by rejecting the authority of the State Church of England, Baptists and Socinians also rejected the authority of the head of the church, a certain guy called James, a.k.a. the King. This made them separatists, and therefore liable to persecution when their rejection of authority became too demonstrative and vocal. But their particular religious beliefs and vulnerable situation also made Socinians and Baptists unusually tolerant. And apparently, it also made some Baptists incredibly brave, or reckless, depending on your temperament. In 1611, Thomas Helwys thought it a good idea to leave his exile in Holland, return to London, set up the first permanent Baptist church, and send a copy to the king of his new book with the following dedication. The king is a mortal man and not God, therefore hath no power over the immortal souls of his subjects to make laws and ordinances for them, to set spiritual lords over them. Helwys' audacity saw him put behind bars, where he died around 1616. But his book, A Short Declaration of the Mystery of Iniquity, became the first English work to argue for complete and universal religious freedom. And by universal, he didn't mean all Christians. Based on a deeply evangelical belief, Helwys argued for the separation of church and state. And when it came to the hated Catholics, whose pope he considered the Antichrist, Helwys nonetheless insisted that they be tolerated. For we do freely profess that our Lord the King has no more power over their consciences than over ours, and that is none at all. For our Lord the King is but an earthly king, and he has no authority as a king but in earthly causes. And if the king's people be obedient and true subjects, obeying all human laws made by the king, our Lord the King can require no more. Oh, and that goes for non-Christians too. For men's religion to God is between God and themselves. The king shall not answer for it. Neither may the king be judged between God and man. Let them be heretics, Turks, Jews, or whatsoever. It appertains not to the earthly power to punish them in the least measure. In many ways, Helwys sounds like Roger Williams, whose idea of mere civility and robust toleration was detailed by Teresa Bijan in episode 12. Only Hilwey's short declaration predates William's bloody tenet of persecution by 32 years. In the following years, books by fellow Baptists Leonard Busher and John Merton pushed the tolerationist agenda further. And Merton, writing in 1615, even took it to the next level. If you favor full religious toleration, you might still draw the line at outright blasphemy or atheism. Sebastian Castellio's famous condemnation of Calvin for burning Servetus was accompanied by a small asterisk. For if Servetus had been an atheist blasphemer rather than a Christian heretic, Castellio would not have been so outraged. He defended unorthodox belief in Christianity, not the vilification or outright rejection thereof. To Merton, blasphemy was certainly an abhorrent sin, blocking the way to salvation, but he still denied worldly powers the right to punish sinful blasphemers. That decision must be left to God on the final day, not to men who was given no such power by God, and who by killing a sinner might prevent him from mending his ways and obtaining salvation. Talk about radical toleration. Merton fared no better than Hilwey's. He too was imprisoned and spent the last miserable 13 years of his life in Newgate Prison. The Baptist radical toleration is one of history's curveballs to those who wish to advance a simplified ideological narrative of the history of religious toleration and free speech. On the one hand, you had a deeply religious and intolerant monarchy building on centuries of legal and theological precedent, Protestant and Catholic, for enforcing religious conformity through often bloody repression. On the other hand, you have a small group of fervent religious believers insisting that the very pages of scripture which centuries of monarchs and their church officials had protected through coercion demands that every human being be allowed to follow his own conscience in matters of religion. That even the mightiest king has no just authority to establish or enforce any official church doctrine. And that even the lowliest subject must be absolutely free to pursue religious truth, even if that means rejecting Protestantism for Catholicism, Islam, or Judaism. So Christianity could be interpreted as both deeply intolerant and radically tolerant. To be sure, at this point in history, the intolerant camp very much held the upper hand and would continue to do so for more than a century. But at the dawn of early modern tolerance and freedom of conscience, the radical proponents of these outrageous ideas were not atheists or skeptics, but fiercely devout and evangelical Christians prepared to pay for their principles with their freedom. Now, while the Baptists might have been principled, their message didn't exactly go viral. There were less than 150 members of the Baptist Church in London around this time, and few were prepared to stand up for them. James also had censorious tendencies when it came to books and pamphlets. In his 22 years as monarch, there were 25 recorded instances of pre- or post-publication censorship of books, including the burning of offending works. Elizabeth only initiated 23 such instances during her 45-year reign. But James also actively used the printing press to his own advantage by publishing propaganda aimed at shoring up support for his rule and policies. He cleverly mixed religion and politics by insisting that he ruled by divine right, which meant that opposition to James was opposition to God. As he wrote in his book, The True Law of Free Monarchies, which he liked to quote to Parliament.
The state of monarchy is the supreme thing on earth. As to dispute what God may do is blasphemy, so is it treason in subjects to dispute what a king may do.
When James died in 1625, a new dynamic duo took over the reins of censorship and defined the limits of tolerance anew. King Charles I and his chief enforcer, the Bishop of London, and from 1633, Archbishop of Canterbury, William Laud, demonstrated an often ruthless willingness to enforce religious uniformity and crack down on political dissent and seditious tendencies. Ultimately, Charles and Laud's intolerance and censorious instincts contributed to the disastrous consequences that befell them both. For the main thrust of their repression was aimed at the fiercely Protestant Puritans and not the tiny group of Baptists and Socinians that James had been able to thwart without breaking sweat. From 1625 to 1640, some 70 cases of post-publication censorship were initiated. Add to this a stricter licensing system through a Kafkaesque multi-tiered system involving both bishops, the wonderfully named Latin secretary, and the private print monopoly of the Stationers' Company. And as we heard in episode 12 with Teresa Bijan, Laud became especially hated for his vigorous enforcement of the Book of Common Prayer and the 39 Articles that defined Anglicanism, which caused thousands of Puritans disgusted with the popish practices of Anglicanism to pack their bags and go west. To these Puritans, Laud's elaborate church ceremonies amounted to Arminianism, a dreaded halfway house on the backsliding road from the true religion of Protestantism to full-blown popery. In the 1620s, Charles issued several proclamations tightening religious censorship. And in 1629, Charles got so sick and tired of quarreling with Parliament that he dissolved it, initiating a period of personal rule lasting 11 years. In the 1630s, the infamous Court of Star Chamber, along with the High Commission Court, gained its notoriety and became a term almost as loaded as that of the Inquisition. In 1633, the Puritan William Prynne was arrested for his book Histriomastics, which had in fact been licensed prior to publication. In Histriomastics, Prynne pretended to attack theatrical plays, but it took little imagination to realize that he was in fact taking aim at both Charles, his Catholic Queen Henrietta Maria, as well as Bishop Laud. Prynne, among other things, wrote of women actors notorious whores, and that those participating in plays were worthy of God's severest judgments. Which was pretty unfortunate, given that the Queen herself acted in plays and that Charles was fond of attending the theatre. Prynne also seemed to compare Charles with the depraved Roman Emperor Nero, infamous for persecuting Christians, and as infected by popery by his Queen. In 1634, Prynne was found guilty of seditious libel and sentenced to have his books burned by the hangman, imprisonment, the pillory, and to have his ears cropped. But Prynne would live on to cause even more serious problems for Charles and Laud, as well as for those who, unlike Prynne himself, were willing to defend the rights of those with whom they disagreed. But Puritan dissent kept pouring out of the presses. So in 1637, the Attorney General issued a Star Chamber decree prohibiting the print, import, or sale of any seditious, schismatical, or offensive books or pamphlets. Even permissible books had to be registered in the Stationer's Register, and so did the full imprimatur of the licensor, the names of the printer, and the author. But the decree also put the Archbishop of Canterbury, i.e. Laud, and the Bishop of London in control of the oversight of the book trade, and gave the Star Chamber and High Commission jurisdiction when it came to the enforcement. Censorship was now ecclesiastical in nature. Punishments were also sharply increased. Anyone guilty of setting up or working in an illegal printing press shall from time to time be set in the pillory and whipped through the city of London. The decree ensured that printers towed the line of licensing, and the number of unlicensed publications slowed considerably the following years. In 1639, the writer and politician Henry Wotton wrote,
"My lodging is so near the Star Chamber that my pen shakes in my hand."
And Wotton was not fretting without cause. For 2 years earlier, Prynne would once again become the protagonist of a sadistic drama. While in prison, Prynne kept writing anonymous Presbyterian pamphlets attacking Laud and Arminianism. And in March 1637, he was once again put on trial along with Henry Burton and John Bostwick. The three men were charged with writing and publishing
diverse scandalous books and libels against the whole clergy of the kingdom and against the government of the Church of England.
Which in a certain sense was true, since they pulled no rhetorical punches against the Laudian ecclesiastical and legal regime. All three had their ears cut off, though Prynne only had stumps left to dismember, and so they were. But then there were other parts of his head left to mutilate. Prynne had his cheeks burned with the letters SNL for seditious libeler, though Prynne quipped that the letters stood for Stigmatis Laudis, the mark of Laud. But far from being broken, Prynne, Bestwick and Burton were galvanized by their public punishment, which turned them into martyrs who were cheered by the crowds as they were pilloried and then shipped off to remote prison cells. One historian argues that Prynne, Bestwick and Burton transformed punishments meant to humiliate and marginalize into a triumph of propaganda, which did much to strengthen the Puritan cause and blacken Charles and Laud's policies and religious agenda. Prynne, Bestwick and Burton were exactly the types of Presbyterian zealots that Thomas Hobbes suggested it would have been better to kill in order to avoid the bloody consequences about to engulf England, as you may remember from episode 12. Charles did not start chopping off heads, but he did up the ante further. In 1638, another Puritan was punished by the Star Chamber for his role in smuggling unlicensed books from Amsterdam. His name was John Lilburn, or Freeborn John. In a few years, he'll become absolutely central as the most prominent figure calling for radical tolerance and free speech among the so-called levelers. But in 1638, Lilburn's procurement of seditious books saw him tied to an ox cart and whipped through London from Fleet Prison to New Palace Yard at Westminster. My Google Maps says that that's a torturous trip of some 1.8 miles. Well, at least he got to keep his ears. But as with Prynne, Burton and Bestwick, the crowd was with Lilburn, who was cheered rather than jeered. Lilburn perfected the role of martyr as he loudly protested while being pilloried and, when gagged, produced illicit pamphlets from under his shirt, which he threw to the adoring crowd. And like Prynne, Lilburn would use his time behind bars to write influential and subversive pamphlets, eroding the support for king and archbishop. His newfound martyrdom gave him the perfect platform to pose as the persecuted champion speaking truth to power on behalf of the ordinary people's suppressed liberty. This was a role which he would perform again and again in the next decade, though Lilburn wasn't playing, and neither were his many opponents. Charles and Laud were not only creating trouble for themselves in England. In that most fateful year of 1637, Charles stepped on a particularly spiky thistle when he sought to impose the Book of Common Prayer on the proudly Protestant and austere Scottish Kirk. Bad move. When the bishop and dean in St. Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh started reading from the prayer book, the fiercely Presbyterian Scots went ballistic and rioted against this black popish superstitious service book. There's a great contemporary account, which really should be quoted in a heavy Scottish accent. But since the police in Scotland once tweeted that it would monitor social media for offensive comments, I'm not going to tempt faith by mangling 17th century Scottish, so you just have to make do with my Danglish.
The Dean, Mr. James Hannah, was mightily upbraided. Some cried, "He's one of a witch's breeding and the devil's offspring. No wholesome water can come forth from such a polluted fountain." One did cast a stool at him, intending to have given him a ticket of remembrance, but ducking became his safeguard at that time.
The bishop barely escaped alive. But when things calmed down, the Scots, now known as the Covenanters, adopted a new and more clever strategy. They flooded England with pamphlets attacking the popish designs of Laud and Charles, stirring the pot of English Puritan dissent and paranoia. To avoid licensing and detection, the Scots also employed printing presses in the Netherlands. You might think of it as an early modern version of VPNs.
And apparently it worked, because in 1639, Charles issued a proclamation to his loving subjects.
They were to stop receiving seditious pamphlets from Scotland and hand those received over to the magistrate. The proclamation was printed in an unprecedented 10,000 copies.
It didn't exactly do the trick, though. And instead of going silent, the Covenanters defeated Charles' English troops in battle. This is the point in time where someone might have told Charles, "Listen, we've tried with strict censorship, we've stiffened penalties, tortured Puritans, and gone to war with the Scots. It doesn't work. Maybe we should try a different tactic?" But Charles was politically tone-deaf. After all, he ruled by divine right. And so instead of smoothing things out, he took it up a notch further on the repression scale.
So in March 1640, Charles issued a second proclamation against Scottish books and pamphlets, which gave anyone in possession of such illegal material 10 days to hand it over to a magistrate or incur the uttermost of punishment and penalties.
Needless to say, the propaganda continued. After a brief and humiliating standoff with the so-called Short Parliament and an even more humiliating second defeat by the Scots, Charles decided to call what is known to history as the Long Parliament. But the MPs were more interested in dismantling the pillars of Charles' personal rule than imposing odious religious policies on the Scots. In 1641, Parliament abolished the Star Chamber, High Commission, and the pre-publication licensing system. And Parliament also released Puritan prisoners of conscience like Prynne and Lilburne. But what prompted this move was not a principled commitment to free speech and liberty of conscience. The famous Root and Branch petition, signed by 15,000 Londoners and presented to Parliament in December 1640, complained first that the Laudian licensing regime had been responsible for
the hindering of godly books to be printed and the blotting or perverting those which they suffer.
So far, so liberal. But then in the very next paragraph, the petition held the ecclesiastical censorship regime accountable for
the publishing and venting of popish, Arminian, and other dangerous books and tenets.
In other words, the problem wasn't censorship as such. It was that Charles and Laud had been censoring the wrong kind of books. This also formed part of the charges against Laud, whom Parliament had arrested for treason and who was beheaded in 1645. Though Parliament was hardly made up by civil libertarians, the abolishment of censorship saw a huge increase in publications. In 1641, 2,177 titles were catalogued, more than at any previous point in English history, and the following year would see a whopping 4,188 titles, which would not be exceeded until the 18th century.
And in 1641, 900 petitions against Church of England ministers appeared by disgruntled citizens unhappy with the liturgy and service of these Laudian tools.
The reason that the number of publications in 1643 didn't top 1642 was that Parliament reintroduced licensing, taking aim at books that were false, forged, scandalous, seditious, and to the great defamation of religion and government. And concerned with what we might today call fake news, disinformation, and propaganda, Parliament forbade the publication of orders and speeches of either of the Houses of Parliament without prior approval. So publishing a speech from an MP held in Parliament was now a crime. The monopoly of the Stationers' Company was back in business, now serving Parliament rather than the King and Lord. It was this reintroduction of licensing in 1643 that prompted John Milton to write Areopagitica, as we discussed in episode 12. And it was also during these intolerant winds that Roger Williams' book, The Bloody Tenet of Persecution, was burned by Parliament in 1644. To no one's surprise, the relationship between Charles and Parliament broke down, and events in Scotland and then Ireland saw things spiral out of control in 1642. I'm not going to get lost in the ins and outs of the Civil War, but for those of you who want the full bells and whistles, podcast history legend Mike Duncan provides a detailed and entertaining narrative in season one of his Revolutions podcast. You can find a link on freespeechhistory.com. Charles' attempt to impose the Common Prayer Book on the Scots and his suppression of Puritan dissent was a masterclass in the sunk cost fallacy. It says that you're on the path to disaster when decisions are based on the amount of time and resources you've spent on an endeavor, even when your repeated failure means you really should just get the hell out of the hole you're busy digging deeper. Although one 17th century historian laid the blame for Charles's demise on anti-royalist propaganda rather than Charles's policies.
I know not any one thing that more hurt the late king than the paper bullets of the press. It was the scandalous and calumniating ink of the faction that from then blackened him and represented all his words and actions to the misguided people who would difficultly have been persuaded to such a horrid rebellion if they had not first been prepossessed by the tongues and pens of the faction.
But God knows that Charles tried to silence the printing presses that bled him of support, one paper cut at a time. And what might have happened if Charles had just tolerated Scottish Presbyterianism and shown latitude towards Puritan sentiments? Might a more tolerant attitude have resulted in fewer of those paper bullets, which the censorship that prompted the PR nightmare in the first place was unable to stop? I guess we'll never know. In 1646, Charles surrendered to Parliament after being crushed by its new model army led by brilliant commanders Oliver Cromwell and Thomas Fairfax. And this is where things get interesting from our point of view, because now a political and religious settlement had to be reached. And despite its victory over the king, the parliamentarian side was divided. In terms of religious policy, you had the Presbyterians who were Calvinist hardliners and independents who were in favor of varying degrees of religious tolerance. And then you had a loose group of people who were not only in favor of radical tolerance, as had been the Baptists, the abolishment of licensing, equality before the law, but also representative democracy based on full male suffrage. Their opponents called them the Levellers. Like Puritan, it was a smear, meant to suggest that they not only believed in equality before the law, but also equality of outcomes to the detriment of private property. It's important to stress that the Levellers were not an organized and unified party with a fully coherent ideology and set of beliefs. But they did wield some influence both among MPs, especially independents, ordinary citizens, and in the new model army. The most prominent Leveller leaders were John Lilburn, the guy who was whipped through the streets of London in 1638, Richard Overton, and William Walwyn. Between them, they published almost 250 pamphlets from 1645 to 1649. Often they had to write from prison when their criticism became too radical. One of the recurrent themes of the pamphlets was liberty of conscience and stripping the magistrate of temporal powers, especially coercive ones, over religious affairs. And crucially, the Levellers used the language of individual and natural rights. Lilburn often appealed to the rights of free-born Englishmen. Historian Rachel Foxley sums up Leveller views on authority and hierarchy like this.
There was no natural human hierarchy in matters of religion, just as there were no natural human hierarchy in political authority. Any authority of one person over another would have to be created by consent, using the original power of the person consenting to be governed.
Sound familiar? In 1645, Lilburn got himself into trouble. He increasingly attacked the Presbyterians for their intolerance on religion and free speech. In one pamphlet, he wrote of
that insufferable, unjust, and tyrannical monopoly of printing, with its oppression of the declarations of the just rights and liberties of the freeborn people of this nation.
And one of his prominent targets was none other than William Prynne, who might have lost his ears for his writings and reveled in his martyrdom back in 1637. But now Presbyterians were dominant in Parliament, and Prynne was motivated by religious zeal, not liberty of conscience or the tolerance of dangerous ideas. When attacked by Lilburn, Prynne complained to a parliamentary committee, and Lilburn was arrested, though quickly released. But shortly thereafter, Lilburn managed to get himself locked up for longer, twice, this time for attacking MPs. This caused William Walwyn to write a public letter to Lilburn called England's Lamentable Slavery,
in which he accused Parliament not only of violating ancient right in the Magna Carta, but also of acting as oppressive as the very King and Court of Star Chamber, which the parliamentary side had defeated and abolished in the name of liberty. The letter was followed up in 1646 by the Remonstrance of Many Thousand Citizens, another protest against Lilburn's imprisonment and thought to be written by Walwyn and Overton. The Remonstrance is often described as the foundational leveller document. It's addressed to members of Parliament whom, according to the authors, was betraying the causes that justified revolting against the king. The word oppressive or oppression is mentioned 19 times throughout the document. And the Remonstrance sets out leveller beliefs in popular rather than parliamentary sovereignty, liberty of conscience, and freedom of the press. The authors wrote that neither Parliament nor none else can have any power at all to conclude the people in matters that concern the worship of God.
And surely, if we could not confer this power upon you, ye cannot have it, and so not exercise it justly. Nay, as we ought not to revile or reproach any man for his differing with us in judgment, more than we would be reviled or reproached for ours, even so ye ought not to countenance any reproachers or revilers or molesters for matters of conscience, but to protect and defend all that live peaceably in the commonwealth, of what judgment or way of worship whatsoever.
The levellers also urge Parliament to allow free speech and
let the imprisoned presses at liberty, that all men's understanding may be more conveniently informed and convinced as fair as is possible by the equity of your proceedings.
The Remonstrance concluded by urging Parliament to fulfill its task of letting the people live in natural and just liberty, agreeable to reason and common equity. But for Overton, the immediate effect of the Remonstrance was not more but less liberty. He was arrested and put behind bars. Their imprisonment and sense of betrayal by former allies likely helped radicalize leveller political ideology and demands. And these would be tested at a number of famous debates where civilian and army levellers sought to convince Cromwell and Ireton, now known as the Grandees, of the need for ambitious constitutional reforms. More specifically, the levellers wanted a unicameral parliament based on universal male suffrage, but which had no power to compel religious belief or opinion. Later, they would also add equality before the law and due process in an elaborate Bill of Rights in their proposed written constitution. These ideas were set out in writings and manifestos such as the Agreement of the People, which were discussed at the famous Putney debates in 1647. This is where a legendary exchange between the leveller colonel Thomas Rainborough and the grandee Henry Ireton took place. Rainborough made the case for universal suffrage and democracy.
I think that the poorest he that is in England hath a life to live as the greatest he. And therefore truly, sir, I think it's clear that every man that is to live under a government ought first by his own consent to put himself under that government. And I do think that the poorest man in England is not bound in a strict sense to that government that he hath not had a voice to put himself under.
To which Ireton coolly replied,
no person hath a right to an interest or share in the disposing of the affairs of the kingdom, and in determining or choosing those that shall determine what laws we shall be ruled by here. No person hath a right to this, that hath not a permanent fixed interest in this kingdom.
In other words, for Ireton, property, not citizenship alone, was the necessary basis for any democratic rights. Okay, so now it's time for another of my homemade analogies. Classicists and historians, prepare to cringe and wince. You may remember from episode 1 and 2, as well as the expert opinion with Professor Paul Cartledge, that the Athenian democracy and Roman Republic had different conceptions of free speech and popular government. The Athenian democracy was based on isagoria, or equality of speech, and was a direct democracy where all freeborn Athenian men had a voice and vote in the affairs of state. In the Roman Republic, free speech was included in the concept of libertas,
but was exercised by the senatorial class and men like Cicero in speeches in the Senate or before popular assemblies. Unlike in Athens, the Roman plebs were not allowed to speak in these assemblies and only got to affirm or reject the proposals put before them after listening to speeches from the elite. So you could argue that the levellers were claiming a form of isigoria with full suffrage for all freeborn men regardless of property, albeit through representative and not direct democracy, whereas Cromwell and Ireton were in favour of a more restrictive form of libertas where only the propertied classes were given a say in the affairs of state. For the levellers, free speech and democracy went hand in hand and required giving a voice to the people through their representatives and the abolishment of licensing laws. For the grandees, democracy had to be limited to a select few, both in terms of who could vote and who was allowed to speak in public. Precisely where the levellers drew the red line when it came to free speech and tolerance is a bit difficult to say. They were not of one mind and were not entirely consistent. In the humble petition of 1649, when under severe attack, the levellers complained that censorship had always introduced
tyranny, men's mouths being to be kept from making noise while they are robbed of their liberties. So was it in the late prerogative times before this Parliament, while upon pretense of care of the public, licenses were set over the press. Truth was suppressed, the people thereby kept ignorant, and fitted only to serve the unjust ends of tyrants and oppressors.
And so, even the least restrained upon the press must be removed, since the people cannot enjoy liberty if stopped from
speaking, writing, printing, and publishing their minds freely.
Another level of pamphlet used the very modern fight bad speech with more speech, not censorship argument.
In case any abuse their authority by scandalous pamphlets, they will never want able advocates to vindicate their innocency, and therefore to refer all books and pamphlets to the judgment, discretion, or affection of licensors, or put the least restraint upon the press, seems altogether inconsistent with the good of the Commonwealth, and expressly opposite and dangerous to the liberties of the people.
This sounds like a rejection, not only of licensing, but also of subsequent restrictions on free speech. We even find levellers explicitly arguing for the importance of being principled for the preservation of liberty. Wrote Walwyn.
I wish you would be but as careful to preserve entirely the due and formal course of law to every man, without exception, friend or foe, as we have been. And though at present you may please yourselves with the sufferings of your adversaries, as you fancy them, yet you do therein but tread down your own hedges, and pluck up that bank that lets in the sea of will and power, overwhelming your own liberties.
Lilburn warned, what is done to anyone may be done to everyone. And when leveller petitions were suppressed and petitioners imprisoned, a leveller argued that petitioning could not be a crime, for no man knows what is sedition. As we'll see in a later episode, this was a position too radical even for many American founding fathers who saw seditious libel as beyond the pale. Just ask John Adams. But in the second agreement of the people, the levellers nonetheless opened the door for excluding faithful Catholics from holding office, and Lilburn seemed to accept licensing of royalist books and pamphlets that tended to the ruin of the kingdom. Walwyn was the most principled of the levellers on free speech, but in his early writings he drew the line at words scandalous or dangerous to the state, whatever that means, though surely it's more fair to judge Walwyn on his later rather than his earlier writings. Despite these small blemishes on their record, it's safe to say that on our journey from antiquity until the 17th century, no one have advocated a more expansive and principled conception of free speech than the levellers. But the idea of democracy and almost limitless free speech remained a pipe dream.
The grandees were able to reject the leveler demands and steadily moved in the direction of increasing censorship and punishment for unlicensed printing, sedition, and treason. And in 1648, Parliament enacted an ordinance which spends 341 words on defining the offense of blasphemy to fit Socinianism, which was punishable with prison or death in case of obstinacy. And in 1649, Parliament gave the Council of State draconian powers to arrest, interrogate, and imprison. The new standing army would play a central role as a tool for Parliament, and in 1649 it was given powers to enforce licensing laws, which included destroying illicit printing presses and the flogging of those who sold unlicensed pamphlets. Naturally, the levelers protested vehemently. In England's new chains discovered, they accused Parliament for
the stopping of our mouths from printing,
and for
dealing with us as the bishops of old did with the honest Puritan.
Running out of patience, Parliament had Walwyn, Overton, Lilburn, and fellow leveller Thomas Price arrested for treason in 1649. And while the levellers wrote a third and final version of the agreement of the people from prison, they were effectively finished as a political movement of any influence. In one last public triumph, Lilburn was acquitted for treason in a jury trial, but he nonetheless died in prison in 1657. After the elimination of the levelers as a political force, the case for democracy, radical tolerance, and free speech was in decline. England became a more centralized state in the so-called interregnum years following the execution of Charles in 1649 and the abolishment of monarchy. And with a standing army, Cromwell had a perfect instrument to enforce the censorship regime in place, as soldiers could search and destroy seditious pamphlets and books. The illiberal development is perhaps best illustrated by one of the great ironies of the history of free speech. John Milton, the scourge of licenses, became a licenser himself. And even though he seems to have been fired for having licensed an offensive Socinian work, it must have required much swallowing of pride for Milton to carry out the very job which he only 5 years earlier had condemned as a popish monstrosity. Milton would also praise the enactment of an additional blasphemy ban in 1650 and vehemently attack the idea of tolerating Catholics in the following decades. So it's surely one of the great injustices of the history of free speech that John Milton, for all his contribution and eloquence, should be remembered as the great 17th century champion of free speech, while most people scratch their heads and go, "Who?" when you mention the names of Lilburn, Overton, and Walwyn. After the restoration of the monarchy in 1660, Parliament introduced the Licensing Act of 1662, which almost rolled back the clock to 1637, and the Star Chamber Decree. It was aimed at
any heretical, seditious, schismatical, or offensive books or pamphlets wherein any doctrine or opinion shall be asserted or maintained which is contrary to the Christian faith or the doctrine or discipline of the Church of England,
or which would be to the
scandal of religion or the Church or the government or governors of the Church, state or commonwealth, or of any corporation or particular person or persons whatsoever.
Only this time, oversight was in the hands of the Secretary of State rather than the Archbishop of Canterbury. But the chief enforcer was surveyor of the imprimary and licenser of the press, the notorious Roger Lestrange, who would become perhaps the most effective and notorious licenser in English history. In 1664, Lestrange boasted that he had seized 31,000 unlicensed pamphlets from booksellers. And in 1670, he estimated the number of different seditious titles he had discovered and suppressed since assuming office to exceed 600. Lestrange was also instrumental in the treason trial against John Twin, who was hanged, drawn, and quartered for printing a pamphlet considered rebellious, a marked and brutal expansion of the crime of high treason to cover mere words, not unlike the invention of the crime of literary treason under the first Roman emperors Augustus and Tiberius, as you may remember from episode 2.
These were indeed dark days for the rights of freeborn Englishmen. Nonetheless, in 1664, the English historian Richard Atkins lamented the consequences of loosening censorship by monarchs in the previous century. Despite licensing laws, the flood of writings from printing presses had filled
the kingdom with so many books and the brains of the people with so many opinions that these paper pellets became as dangerous as bullets.
Among the bullets with the longest half-life and which provoked the most durable opinions in the brains of people for centuries to come were the radical ideas of democracy, free speech, and religious tolerance, which the levelers rapid-fired indiscriminately into the public imagination in the last half of the 1640s. And while the paper bullets fired by the levelers were unable to pierce the armor of censorship and privilege, they still made dents that could be exploited to devastating effects by later generations of radicals for free speech and democracy. If the idea of liberty of conscience, free speech, and democracy was already developed in the first half of the 17th century, why do we so often hear that these are Enlightenment values? Why do we worship the names of Spinoza, Diderot, Jefferson, and Paine, but never hear of Lilburn, Overton, and Walwyn? One reason might be that the levelers fought a lost cause and were swiftly defeated. Had the agreement of the people been as influential in shaping England's political landscape as Tom Paine's common sense was to be for the idea of American independence, the levelers would undoubtedly be celebrated as intellectual rock stars. Yet levelers' ideas of free speech and democracy were vastly more radical and egalitarian than even the Whiggish principles that triumphed with the Glorious Revolution of 1688 and the Bill of Rights in 1689. But historian C.J. Davis provides another interesting argument that distinguishes the justifications for liberty of conscience that motivated deeply devoted Puritans on the one hand and secular-minded radical Enlightenment thinkers on the other. I should say that Davis' interpretation is not undisputed among historians, and I think, or maybe I hope, that he is perhaps too ungenerous. But his words of warning are a helpful corrective to those who see a direct line from the levelers to modern secular democracies, where both socialists on the left and libertarians on the right have tried to claim the levelers as theirs. Davis argues that for the Puritans, the central justification for religious liberty was not based on self-determination or autonomy from authority. And while the levelers were more principled and expansive than other Puritan proponents of tolerance, Davis argues that ultimately they too were motivated by religious rather than civil ideas. In Davis' words,
"The claim of liberty of conscience had virtually nothing to do with a claim to direct or manage ourselves. It was a claim to be free to submit to the governance of God rather than to any other authority."
So man was not free to surrender his conscience to the magistrate because his conscience was not free to give away, but had to conform to the dictates of God. Ultimately, liberty of conscience would, many Puritans believe, result in religious uniformity, which was seen as a good. If Davis is right, then we can more clearly differentiate the levelers from someone like, say, Spinoza, Paine, and radical philosophers like Diderot, for whom free speech was about self-liberation and a natural consequence of their rejection of the authority of religion, church, and state over the minds of men, and their commitment to laws based on secular rather than religious principles. The ideas of these Enlightenment thinkers gained much more traction as part of the Enlightenment's contestation of the authority of churches and kings in 18th century Europe and America than did the levelers' short-lived and ill-fated plea for radical toleration and liberty of conscience in 17th century England. And in our secular age, it's perhaps also easier for many to identify with the more radical Enlightenment, secular and universal justifications of free speech than ones depending on devout and specific theological interpretations that few in the 21st century are prepared to accept and follow. But this does not mean that we should neglect the historical significance of the levelers. Even if their justifications for free speech might have been more narrow than those necessary for broad acceptance in modern diverse and secular democracies. Leveler language and principles are still capable of stirring the modern imagination. On paper, they sound almost identical with democratic principles such as developed in the Bill of Rights to the US Constitution, and can easily be adapted to more inclusive models of free speech than those which Lilburn and his allies might have had in mind themselves. And to me, the leveler justifications for free speech seem impossible to separate from their commitment to popular sovereignty and human equality. That's sufficiently secular and modern for me. And I hope that modern Britons will look more to the levelers than William Lord or Roger Lestrange when determining the limits of free speech in the 21st century. Thank you very much for listening. Today's episode was edited by Søren Stehøj. If you liked the podcast, or if you were offended, please let us know and leave a review on iTunes and share on social media. And if you're in London this weekend, I'll be speaking at the Battle of Ideas Festival at the Barbican on Saturday, the 13th of October, and would love to meet and talk with any followers of the podcast while I'm in town.